IOX is supported by Pika Moose Restaurant on State Route 28 in Big Indian, with farm-to-table cuisine Thursday through Monday, indoor dining at a safe distance from 4 to 9 p.m., and patio-heated outdoor dining on the moonlit deck. Take out till 10. PikaMoose.com or 845-254-6500, 845-254-6500. WIOX is supported by Margaretville Hospital, a member of Westchester Medical Center Health Network, with a pharmacy open to the public in the hospital lobby. The Margaretville Hospital Pharmacy, a participant in New York State's Drug Take Back program, improving water quality and protecting public health by taking back outdated prescriptions and keeping them out of rivers and waterways. More information at 845-586-1344 or hahv.org. WIOX is supported by What the Soap, WTS and Company in Prattsville, for soaps and lotions made on site, locally handcrafted candles, pottery, jewelry, art, and gifts, and a hand-picked selection of books on homesteading, nature, and local history. WTS and Company in the Prattsville Plaza and online at whatthesoap.com.
Hello, this is Rosina Montana, and I host Various Voices, alternate Thursday afternoons at 2, right here on WIOX Roxbury Community Radio. We're live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXradio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, on smart devices through the Radio FM app, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
Doing fine, you know. Let's see. What have I been up to? I sprayed my apple trees with some Surround, Kaolin clay.
Okay, we learned that on the radio program three weeks ago, right?
Yeah, it's in the archives. Peter Jench, Hudson Valley Research Lab out of Highland, Ulster County. It's their joint with Cornell and paid for by the Orchardist of Hudson Valley. But, Kaolin clay, if you want to go the organic route, suppresses a whole wide range of insects. But if you spray now at petal fall, you can control plum curculio, I think it was what it is, right? Which can deform fruit or lead to early fruit drop.
All right.
So the trees are white.
Yeah, it turns them white.
Yeah, oh yeah. Which for me is really good because my trees face south, and they get a lot of sunlight. and sunscald can be an issue. So now that the bark is white, that'll reflect light. That's good.
Okay. I had two reports, two different people tell me today that they found morel mushrooms today.
No kidding.
So if you're a morel mushroom hunter, now's the time. I guess that it happens when the soil temperature hits a certain degree and they pop up, as far as I know.
Huh.
So I guess they're the best, but I've never gotten to try one.
I finally got one, I think last year or the year before, and they're really good. Oh, yeah. They're worth it.
All right. Well, I mean, I like to go for a walk every day, so maybe in the next day or two, maybe I'll find one. But
yeah,
I don't know. They like disturbed sites. I hear they like to be near elms, so makes sense. Down in a river valley, there's the disturbed sites along the stream banks.
Yeah, apples.
Apples.
You know,
orchards.
Seems like good soil, but yeah. Tonight we're talking about Lyme disease and invasive species with the University of Connecticut's Tom Worthley. And he's an associate extension professor at UConn, Cooperative Extension Service, and UConn Department of Natural Resources and the Environment. Tom has written a number of scholarly articles and also teaches courses in forest ecology and management and dendrology. He has worked extensively on tracts in the UConn forest and beyond in both outreach and educational activities. Let me see if I can get him on. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I am. If you can hear me, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming on, and yes, we can hear you crystal clear. How are things in Connecticut?
Well, it was a beautiful day in Connecticut, and when you talk about things that are coming up in the springtime here, the early spring, one of the things that we're seeing in parts of Connecticut is that we're in the middle of the season for ramps. And I don't know if you've ever heard of ramps, but ramps are a kind of wild leek. And they're very common south of here, down into Delaware and Maryland, and down into North Carolina and places like that, where they're very popular, and people pick them. In fact, they have whole festivals that are devoted to ramps. And I managed to gather a few ramps the other day, and I sautéed them up with some butter and some rice and some other vegetables. They were pretty good.
Oh, yeah, we get them quite abundantly here. My mother pickles them, and my wife blanches them and freezes them for future use in the freezer.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you can enjoy them.
Yeah, they're definitely a treat, that's for sure. And actually, they're there all year round. I like to dig them up when I'm deer hunting in November, actually.
Have oh, really?
A little snack on my
great.
Little snack on my sandwich. But, of course, the leaves are gone, so you can't find them. You got to look for their little tiny, tiny seed heads. And
yep.
If you know where to look, you're going to find
That's
them.
Right.
Like I said,
right.
I like to throw them on a sandwich while I'm deer hunting.
We find them in the rich soils where there's abundant sugar maple and ash, that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, that's probably why we have so many. We're in the heart of the sugar maple range here in the Catskill Mountains for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, well-drained soil, calcium-rich, we got plenty of those, and trout lilies, too, seem to grow around them. See a lot of trout lilies near the ramps.
Yeah, we've been seeing those, too.
Yeah, I like them. They're pretty good, you know, just as a snack. So, Tom, what got you into researching Lyme disease and ticks?
Well, it's a bit of a story, but we were experimenting with the idea of controlling unwanted vegetation using propane torches. The notion being that historically fire was a fairly common occurrence in the upland forests in our part of the world prior to European settlement, and the very dense understory shade that we get from thin bark species like beech and black birch and red maple and some of the ironwoods was not as common at that time as it is now that we suppress fire. And so I had this idea of, could we bring the fire in a way that we don't actually have to have a fire but can have directed flame? And so we were experimenting with, flame girdling, unwanted vegetation in forest stands. And one of the folks working with me, Dr. Jeffrey Ward from the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station, decided that, well, let's try this on some other unwanted vegetation, Japanese barberry, and see if we can make it go away. And the first unscientific trials seemed to be very successful. It didn't take very long to place a handheld propane torch. I'm talking about a flame weeder type of torch, one that you hold in your hand as a long wand and press a trigger, and a very hot flame comes out the end about 3 feet away. And you can get them at 100,000 BTUs. You can get them at 400,000 BTUs. So we were experimenting on the Japanese barberry and found that it was initially very effective in terms of killing off the upper part of the barberry plant. And so we set up a designed experiment to test the flame weeding against other forms of control, like herbicide and that sort of thing. And in the process of doing that, we found that the workers who were helping us set up the experiment were coming out at the end of the day loaded with ticks, tons of ticks on their clothing and their skin from these barberry patches. And we wondered why, why are the ticks so abundant in the barberry patches? And that led to some further research on ticks and Lyme disease and that sort of thing in the type of environment that the large barberry patches create. So there's the long answer to your question.
Before we go into the treatments and stuff, just a little background on Lyme's disease and ticks. I mean, I guess it's named after what? Lyme, Connecticut? Is that? I don't even know where Lyme, Connecticut is. Is that right?
Lyme, Connecticut is a community that's down along the shoreline, just east of the mouth of the Connecticut River, and has a part of its boundary on the Connecticut River, and part of it just north of what we call Old Lyme, which is down right on the shoreline, and on Long Island Sound. And Lyme was the first place that the disease was identified. A patient who lived in Lyme was the first person who had the conclusive diagnosis of a new disease, and they decided to name it after the community where that person came from was Lyme, Connecticut. And as it so happens, Lyme, Connecticut is also a place that very loaded with patches of Japanese barberry bushes.
And, how prevalent is the disease throughout the Northeast, would you say? Do you know?
Well, Lyme disease has spread all over the country. It is, you can catch it from ticks all over the place now. How do I want to put this? It's probably most common in the New England states and the Northeast states right around New England, and then decreasing a little bit from there. But you can catch a Lyme disease from a tick, a black-legged tick, and just about anywhere that black-legged ticks happen to be.
All right, here's the thing that I don't understand. You said black-legged tick. So are there different types of ticks? And if so, what are they?
Well, I don't know all of the names of all the ticks, but there's a fairly sizable variety of ticks out there, and the black-legged tick being just one of them. It's also known as the deer tick. It's very common on white-tailed deer, but there are dog ticks, and there is a tick called the Lone Star tick. Several different ticks that are in the environment, and several of them carry different assortments of disease. For example, the Lone Star tick carries a disease that will give you an allergy to red meat. You can become, if you have a bite from a Lone Star tick, you can develop an allergy that makes eating red meat deadly to you.
Alpha-gal syndrome. I know just got it. Girl my wife went to college with out of...
What a shame.
She got
what
it in Nebraska, though. Nebraska?
Yeah, Lone Star Texas. They're named Lone Star because not because they came from Texas, but because they have a little white patch that looks like a little star on their back, in the back of their neck, so to speak. And but they're all over the country too.
Jesus, I didn't know that. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah,
but deer ticks carry quite a variety. The deer ticks or the black-legged ticks carry a variety of different diseases. They don't. Not every tick carries all the diseases, but Lyme disease, ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, babesiosis. I have had babesiosis myself from a tick bite, and several others that you're at risk of if you have a tick bite. Mm. And the ticks are not born with these diseases. They get them from animals where they get their blood meals. So usually the first blood meal that a tick gets is from a mouse or some other small, furry, rodent-type creature, and diseases are picked up by the ticks from those critters and then passed along to others.
And that's what you would call, from watching your presentation, reservoirs, mice, chipmunks, et cetera?
That's correct. That's correct. They would be reservoirs of the disease and... you know, I have a photograph in one of my presentations of a mouse, and they're just counting the ticks on the ear of the mouse, and there's 12 ticks just on one ear.
Jeez.
Of that little mouse. Wow. Little tiny, tiny little ticks that have just hatched out. So those ticks are getting their first blood meal from a mouse, and the mouse is likely passing on the bacteria or other germs that are associated with these diseases.
So, Tom, last year, early summer, I was taking my daughter, and we happened to go through a brushy patch, unfortunately. And I never seen anything like it. There was small ticks. Looks like, I guess, they were nymphs, because I never saw so many of them in my life. Can you go over the life cycle real quick what should we be looking out for this time of year and as the growing season progresses?
Well, the ticks are born from an egg, of course. The adult tick lays a bunch of eggs, and the eggs will hatch out. In the very first, they go through four stages of growth, and each stage requires a blood meal for them to shed their outer coating and grow to a new size. And the first ticks, when they first hatch out, are very, very tiny. They're, you know, they're described as being smaller than the head of a pin. And so this time of year, when the ticks are first hatching out, you need to be very, very observant. Look very carefully. You know, you can look down when a tick is approaching its adult stage, and you see it's fairly large, or you can feel it crawling on your skin. But these little tiny, tiny ticks are almost impossible to see unless you look very closely. So, you know, people have to, help you look yourself over if you've been through a brushy area. Once the tick has had a blood meal, it will shed its outer coating and grow a new one and be a little bit larger size, and they'll be a little bit easier to see. But it's the second stage. It's the second instar that they're dangerous. Because they're likely to have picked up some kind of disease from another animal. So the slightly larger ticks are probably more dangerous than the tiny, tiny, tiny ones. And then the larger they get, probably the more dangerous they become.
I see. That makes sense. I think, John.
And to finish this story, I'm sorry. They'll try to take several blood meals during the course of the growing season and achieve adult stage by the end of the growing season. And they may overwinter as an adult, and, unless they're successful laying eggs in it, before the wintertime comes.
Yeah, that's what I was always taught, that there's when they first come out after a snowmelt or in the spring, when you first see them, there's always two sizes, and that's what you're looking at, is the overwintering adults and the newly hatches.
Right, right.
Yeah, I've noticed that for sure.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Lyme disease and invasive species with University of Connecticut's Tom Worthley. So, Tom, how do deer contribute to this whole mess?
Well, deer are, of course, a warm-blooded mammal, and they will be passing through the forest, through the underbrush, through the understory, and, you know, browsing and feeding as they go along. And especially where there's native young growth. Now, deer have not evolved to feed on species that are not native to our part of the world. So any shrub or plant that's growing out in the woods that's a non-native species or an invasive species is unlikely to be browsed by the deer. They'll be eating the native plants. And especially in places where there's native shrubs or native young growth, you know, where there's plenty for the deer to browse on. The ticks spend most of their time in the duff, in the leaves, in the fallen leaves down near the soil. But if the humidity is right and the temperature is right, then they'll crawl up onto lower branches of the shrubbery or lower branches of the young trees, and they'll hang out there waiting for some warm-blooded creature to walk by. And if they do, then they'll reach out, they'll latch on, and they'll crawl into the fur, and they'll burrow their way into the hide of the, in this case, the deer. You know, so the deer, just in browsing, just kind of wandering around, browsing on young shrub growth or young tree growth, is an ideal in an ideal situation to be picked up by a questing tick, and because the tick is hanging out on the tips of the branches. When the when it gets too dry, the ticks will drop off and they'll go back down into the duff layer. When the humidity is a little higher, and this would be, for example, early in the morning when the dew point is high, or in the evening when the temperature changes a little bit, that's when the deer come out to browse, and that's when the ticks come out to quest. And so they latch onto the deer. The deer has very few ways of getting a tick off once it's attached, and so the tick gets its blood meal and then drops off in some kind of different location because the deer has been wandering around. And so that particular tick will wind up laying its eggs in a different place from where it was born.
Amazing. Deer, yeah, I've seen some deer with some pretty nasty ticks on them. If you're just tuning in, yeah, listening to From the Forest, tonight's topic is Lyme disease and invasive species with UConn's Tom Worthley. We're going to take a break, but up next, we're going to ask Tom why we should care about barberry, ticks, Lyme disease, and whatnot.
Today is another day to find you shying away. I'll be coming for your love, okay, and take on me. Take me on. I'll be say I'm odds and ends, but that's me, I'm stumbling away, slowly learning that life is okay, and say after me, it's no better to be safe than sorry, and take on. things that you say. Is it life or just to play my worries away? You're all the things I've got to remember. You're shying away. I'll be coming for you anyway. Take on me. Take me on. I'll be gone in a day.
The song that can't be done on karaoke, John. That's right.
I won't try.
Yeah, well, see, you get 10 drinks, you might, but you'll embarrass yourself.
No, I don't think I will.
Anyway, this is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Lyme disease and invasive species with UConn's Tom Worthley. Tom, so why should we care about barberry, ticks, deer, whatnot?
Well, as we discussed earlier, the ticks carry an assortment of fairly dangerous diseases, some that can have lifelong consequences like Lyme disease or anaplasmosis or something like that, Eastern equine encephalitis, for example. And the ticks find their first blood meals probably on small animals like mice and other rodents, and the invasive shrubs like Japanese barberry provide an ideal habitat for the mice. And if you know the plant, I'm not giving you any new information, but if you don't know Japanese barberry, it's a low shrub. The clumps of barberry can get to be waist high, sometimes armpit high, but usually they're lower than that. But they're comprised of multiple stems that all grow from a central root crown. And it's a woody root crown that sits just at the soil surface. And these branches arc up and over and aim back down towards the ground. And they're loaded with thorns. They're loaded with small leaves. Because of the way they arc out of the root crown, they're ideal questing sites for ticks. And when they're growing all together, when there's been barberry in the area for a while, they grow in these dense patches that expand like a cancer and across the landscape. And underneath these patches is ideal mouse habitat. The mice are protected from predators. There's plenty of low-hanging fruits. The nuts and seeds from the overstory trees drop into these patches and provide a food source for the mice. And the mice, in turn, provide a blood meal for the ticks. And in a questing site, you know, the deer come along nibbling on anything that's native, and other animals that pass through will pick up ticks and spread them around. And so the barberry itself can be considered, those large patches of barberry can be considered a human health risk in the landscape.
And you're saying that there's a correlation, there's 10 times more ticks in barberry?
Well, what they found was 10 times more ticks that were infected with Lyme disease spirochetes in ticks on mice that came from Japanese barberry patches than there were on ticks from mice that were trapped in open woods.
Okay. All right. And did that study compare to native shrubs like mountain laurel or fern or anything? I've heard that there's none really in fern, but I'm not sure.
Well, all they did was compare. They trapped mice in barberry patches, and they had just as many traps in patches of woods that did not have barberry. But we didn't keep track of exactly what was there instead. But there would have been an assortment of native shrubs, you know, mountain laurel, like you say, or spice bush, or, you know, something like that out there. But very seldom, except in the case of mountain laurel, do you find the thickets of shrubs as dense as you do with the barberry. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
I think so, too. The problem is, like, growing up in the Hudson Valley, there's just nothing growing when there's no barberry. And the native shrub layer is just so hammered. You know what I mean? It's tough to get a true comparison or a, what do you call, like a control, rather. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it would be, you know, mainly because of that, because the deer are eating everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing I've been thinking about this a while, and what I don't understand is, you know, we have people that live at 2,500 feet in elevation, some, 26, maybe 27. And there's ticks up there now. And this is what I don't get. The forest is maturing. Our shrub layer is actually decreasing in the Catskill Mountains. We have some of the most mature forests in the Northeast. Yet people are like, we never had ticks before, and now we do. Like, what is the deal with that?
Well, I would hazard a guess, because I don't know the answer for sure. But it would have to do with the movement of other animals, animals that are more abundant now than they used to be before we had ticks. So there's a couple of factors out there. Years ago, when I was a kid, the farmers always burned their fields, and now nobody does that anymore.
Right.
Can you imagine that that burning of the fields would have eliminated a lot of ticks? Okay.
That makes sense.
There is a decrease in the numbers in terms of bird population, and there's also a decrease in the diversity of species. And birds are phenomenal at finding ticks and eating them, especially the birds that that are ground birds. You know, your turkeys and your ruff grouse and birds like that are great at finding ticks and eating them, and so there may be fewer of those around. The other thing is that there aren't so many predators out there, and these would be animals that prey on mice and chipmunks and squirrels and things like that are not so abundant, and so there's more mice, which means there's more ticks, and they're being spread around. Not to mention the, you know, hunting pressure is lower these days. I don't know about the Catskills, but I know over here in Connecticut there isn't nearly as much hunting pressure as there used to be.
Yeah, our deer numbers in the Catskills have peaked in most areas in the 90s or even before. Some even peaked in the 70s and 80s.
Uh-huh.
So it's not so much a deer issue, but the fire is very interesting to me because there's definitely less fire everywhere there is. And in some places, you know, everyone's grandfather used to burn on the hillsides up to the 1930s and 40s, you know, but that has obviously gone away.
Yeah, and we opened the conversation in a discussion about, you know, burning in the upland forest in general. That was very common. Low-intensity, relatively common fires occurred every 10 or 15 years in the upland forest. A lot of times they were set by Native Americans who wanted to keep the forest open for a variety of reasons, but fires like that would have been very detrimental to any kind of tick population.
Yeah, I think fire is kind of like a disinfectant, you know. I think a lot of our tree diseases are brought over. I'm just guessing here, but a lot of our tree diseases are brought over overseas. But also, fires like that disinfects things too, you know, with diseases and insects and whatnot. I mean, down south, when I lived down there, they burn a lot more to control the chiggers and ticks.
Right, and you know, I grew up in New England, and our other common name for red maple is swamp maple, and I guess it has that name. My guess is that it has that name because that's, you know, the old Yankees, that's where they found it. is in the swamps because, you know, before they moved there, it wasn't part of the upland. It was relegated to the wet areas that didn't burn.
Yeah, so, that makes sense.
Now it's everywhere. Now it's everywhere.
It's New York's number one stem, I believe.
It is.
Yeah, I believe you're right. Connecticut too.
All right, so time is flying by. Let's get into some treatments. You know, what can we do? What can we do to reduce barberry or ticks and their diseases?
Well, the first thing is to recognize barberry. For those who aren't familiar with it, like I said, it grows as a multiple stemmed shrub that grows out of a single root cap, and when the plant is small, you can put on a pair of leather gloves and just yank it right out of the ground, and it's, you know, hang it upside down somewhere where the roots will dry out, and that'll be the end of it. It's most advantageous to get it when it's not very abundant like that. You see a few barberry bushes around, why yank them out of the ground as soon as you see them. You recognize it by the very, very sharp thorns that it has. If you break the stem open, it has a yellow color to it, and the leaves are very small. They're kind of teardrop shape, smooth around the edges, and they grow in clusters on the branches. And so you see that, yank it out of the ground if you can. And then if it's a large clump or a large bush, or it's a sort of a stand of barberry, then the treatments that we have suggested are is a two-step process where the first step is a mechanical treatment, meaning you cut it off. You cut everything off the top and allow it to resprout, because it will. And when a plant like that resprouts, it's using reserves from the roots to give it the nourishment it needs to resprout. And if you cut it again, it has fewer reserves to draw on and won't resprout quite as vigorously the second time. And if you cut it a third time, that might be enough to kill it. Now, I'm talking about 4 to 6 weeks during the growing season in between cuttings. So you go out and you cut the barberry now. You go back in the end of June, cut it again, go back in August and cut it again. You may just be done with it. Now, if you don't have the patience to do the cutting, then the next best thing would be to cut it now or cut it in midsummer and have somebody following you around with a little squirt bottle of some kind of herbicide and just squirt the cut stumps, you know, the little stumps of the little branches that are growing out of the rootstock. The plant is drawing things down at that point in time, and they'll take that herbicide right down into the roots, and that'll kill the plant. We have also tried, as I described earlier, direct flame. And while we can kill a large barberry clump with directed flame, it's kind of time-consuming, and it's a little expensive. You use a lot of propane. It's fun. I mean, you know, if you have a teenager hanging around and you say, hey, you want to try my flamethrower? Why? You'll have all kinds of free labor. But the point is that, once again, if you do a mechanical treatment, if you cut the thing and then you wait for it to resprout and you go back and flame the sprouts, you'll have a lot more effective mortality on the barberry. And then finally, if you can't get right to the freshly cut stump with a little bit of herbicide, then you can wait for it to resprout and go back and hit the sprouts with some herbicide. You use a lot less herbicide product on the sprouts than you would on a fully grown bush if you're trying to use a foliar spray.
Yeah, we do some of that here at CFA. Catskill Forest Association on our full-time jobs. Do some of that foliar spray. It's very effective, very effective. Later in the season is usually best when that plant is starting to senesce back into the root system. It helps translocate that chemical for us. So usually a single treatment is all you need. You won't get any resprouting. So from what I know, I guess earlier in the season, if you treat it, you might get resprouting with foliar and have to do it twice. So
that's correct.
Yeah,
that's correct.
The only
downside of broadcast foliar spray is that you run the chance of hitting something that's non-target. And so if you are spraying mid-season, you're better off cutting first and hitting the resprouts because it's a much smaller area that you have to hit. And you're less chance of hitting something that you don't want to hit with a herbicide. Late in the season, there's a little bit of window of time because one of the advantages that barberry has is that it leafs out earlier than everything else, and it holds its leaves longer than everything else. When all the other native plants are dropping their leaves for the fall, barberry still has some green leaves on it, and there's an opportunity there to do some foliar spray as well.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing, even up till even just beyond the first frost, even.
That's correct.
So as long as the leaves are on it and green, you can spray?
Yep.
Okay. Yep. What's the advantages and disadvantages of flame versus chemical?
Well, we don't go as far as saying that that flame is organic, because it's not. You're using propane. It does produce carbon dioxide when it burns, but it's non-chemical. And most of our native, as we just discussed, fire being fairly common in the upland forest environment, historically, most of our native plants are adapted to there being some fire and are adapted to being burned, and if they get burned, they resprout. Whereas some of our non-native plants are not adapted that way, and so there's an advantage in some seasons, especially if there are non-target plants around. That if you're using a directed flame, you'll kill the barberry plant. You may knock back something next to it that's native, but the native thing will regrow.
Yeah, and labor it, as far as labor, one versus the other?
The herbicide is a little bit less labor-intensive. You can do more acres in a day or more parts of an acre in a day than you can with directed flame. You know, directed flame is kind of a slow process.
And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Lyme disease and invasive species with UConn's Tom Worthley. So, Tom, can you tell us a little bit about this study, this 28 study areas you've been involved in?
Well, the study areas were established initially to test the control methods to see how directed flame worked with in comparison to two different types of herbicide. We used a glyphosate-based herbicide, and we used a tricloper-based herbicide and directed flame, and then, of course, we had a control area. And we found that this two-step mechanical and then follow-up treatment was effective using all of those things. And the mortality rate was just as high with the directed flame than with the herbicide treatments treating resprouted Japanese barberry. Okay, as an aside, we tried the same not in the scientific way, but we tried the same treatment on multiflora rose, and it seemed to work pretty well. When we tried directed flame on Oriental bittersweet, we found that the Oriental bittersweet, certainly the upper part of the vine was killed, but the roots would send up sprouts like crazy. So I'm not recommending using directed flame on Oriental bittersweet. You're better off either repeated cutting or herbicide treatment on that. But while we were doing those experimental treatments to compare the treatments, we also set up deer exclosure areas where part of the treatment site was excluded from deer, and part of the site was, you know, deer were allowed to access, and the idea was to see how well the sites would regenerate with native plants if barberry was removed and deer were excluded. And, you know, sure enough, of course, we got lots more native regrowth in the areas where the deer was excluded.
Yeah, I believe it. I have a 8-foot fence in my backyard, and there's only one spot that I don't, like, cultivate. And, yeah, there's tons of stuff growing up there, and mostly natives. You know, the red maple are coming in, and oak and sugar maple. It's great. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so what you're saying is if they're giving an equal playing field, the natives are winning. Is that it or no?
Yes, I would say they are. I mean, you get a little bit of seeding in from birds. You know, there are a few birds that will feed on the fruits of Japanese barberry in the wintertime when other food sources are scarce. You get some other, depending on the soil, you might get some other invasives. We had an area that on one side, it was notable. We eliminated all the Japanese barberry only to come back the next growing season and, you know, see a big patch of garlic mustard instead. You know, so sometimes you can't win for losing. But if you have a native seed source, you know, particularly for shrubs or spring ephemerals, they will come back slow but sure. One of the very interesting things I would like to see done would be a seed bank study across the Northeast, just to see what seeds are in the soil waiting for the opportunity to grow. You know, it would be a very interesting study to see.
Yeah, I feel like the longer we wait to manage our forest, I mean, that eventually the native seed bank, you would think, gives out. Right? I mean, I don't know.
Well, you know, the interesting thing that I don't know enough about is that so many different species have seeds that retain viability for different periods of time. You know, so, for example, an acorn may only have a year of viability in the soil, whereas a seed from a pin cherry might be viable for 50 years and just wait for that right combination of temperature and light to, you know, to germinate and grow.
Yeah, yeah, I remember in school there was like 50 to 75 years for a fire cherry or pin. I don't remember which.
Yeah. And so I don't know enough about our non-native species, whether there's a seed bank there that allows them to germinate when certain disturbances take place. You know, we have the problem with beech that, as soon as there's the slightest disturbance, the beech roots send up sprouts and create whole clones of beech trees, sometimes where you don't want them.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Lyme disease and invasive species with UConn's Tom Worthley. We're going to take a break, but we'll finish up asking Tom where he thinks things are going in the future with ticks, Lyme disease, and deer.
Maybe I'm lost. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost. Too many people you used to know. They see you coming, they see you go. They know your secrets, you know theirs. This town is crazy, nobody cares. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost. Come. I'm tired of fighting. I'm tired of fighting. Fighting for a lost cause. There's a place we're all going. You ain't never been before. No one left to let you back now. No one's standing at your door. That what you thought love was for. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost. Baby, you're lost. I'm tired of fighting. Tired of fighting, fighting for a lost cause.
All right, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is Lyme disease and invasive species with University of Connecticut's Tom Worthley. So, Tom, where do you see the future going with ticks, Lyme disease, barberry?
Well, this is where I would advocate for the notion of forest management in general. There's a lot of debate about whether we should be managing our forests or just leaving them alone with the, you know, debate about the role that forests play in sequestering carbon and all of that kind of thing. But I would have to remind folks that different species of trees have different life expectancies, and not every tree is going to live to be that 300-year-old old-growth tree. And we need to think about if we want there to be 100-year-old trees 100 years from now. We need to have one-year-old trees today, and that requires some effort for management to ensure that desirable regeneration. We can't expect it to happen on its own, because in our part of the world, the deer will eat everything that's not that's native. A struggling oak seedling may not stand a chance in places where the deer population is high, and where they the things that the deer don't eat, like Japanese barberry and multiflora rose, turn into these vast spreading patches of dense undergrowth that harbor the mice and in turn harbor the ticks and are the sources of the diseases that that we've been talking about. And so controlling the invasives, ensuring the desirable regeneration that we're looking for through the appropriate management techniques for the soil and the forest type that you have is going to be very important in ensuring that there's a productive and useful an enjoyable forest for our children and grandchildren to enjoy. That's a little bit of a soapbox, but that's that's how I answer your question.
Yeah, I agree. The pendulum's got to swing back to where maybe humans are a part of nature again, you know, get their hands dirty, get involved in forest mm-hmm. management, because I don't think it's been happening for the last few decades or so, at least not here in the Catskills as much as it probably should.
Yeah. Well, you know, people are understandably reluctant to see those disturbances that forest management can involve, but you know, there are many of the species that we consider to be quite common. You know, our red oaks and our white oaks are disturbance dependent. You know, they will not regenerate naturally on their own unless there's some kind of disturbance that lets light in and stimulates that regrowth. And many of our human caused disturbances can be done in such a way as to overwhelm the deer or put in techniques that discourage the deer. I don't know if you're familiar with the slash wall program that they're doing down at Cornell. You know, to regenerate a stand with to regrow an oak forest where there was an oak forest. They're using all of the tops and branches from the trees they harvest to build a wall around the area to keep the deer out, you know, at least for a while, until yeah. the seedlings get tall enough to be over the heads of the deer. So there's a number of techniques that we can use to help to ensure that happening. But when you think of the amount of young forest that we need these days and middle-aged forest that we need to be present in order to replace the old forest that doesn't make it to be an old-growth forest, you know, we need a bit more. We yep. need a bit more of it.
Age class diversity, it's important. Tom, thanks for coming on. We're out of time, and we appreciate, you know, you taking the time out of your day and talking about Lyme disease, ticks, deer, barberry.
Well, I'm very grateful for the invitation, and it's been great talking to you, and thank you very much for inviting me.
All right, thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye. All right, and that's all we have on From the Forest tonight, and have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Upon his cart he lay, and he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. Above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps. And to an old forgotten soul